ready to go. Looking real good in my passport photo. Oh,
no. Amateur Traveler episode 240. Today the Amateur Traveler talks about kiwis and geysers and blackwater rafting as we go to New Zealand. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Before we get into today's topic of New Zealand, I do have three news stories for you. The first one should be a warning to all of us who may, at times when we're on an airline, forget to keep our seatbelt fastened, even though the pilot has told us to. There was a United flight that hit turbulence that was, I believe, unexpected and certainly very sudden. And basically, the quote was that if you don't have your seatbelt on, you got hurt. And so please, 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 if you're on an airline and you're in your seat, keep your seatbelt fastened and don't get up if the pilot has the seatbelt sign turned on. And then there's two sets of new rules that have gone into play recently. One we have talked about before, which is the new airline law that is trying to keep people from being stranded on the runway. And so the U.S. Department of Transportation put in new tarmac rules. And surprise, surprise, when you tell the airlines that if they keep people on the runway too long, you are going to fine them significant amounts of money, they are not keeping people on the runway. Instead, they are canceling flights. And so the impact of the new law is 400,000 delayed passengers. I'd like to say that that's a complete surprise, but I'm afraid anyone who looked at that should have seen that coming. The U.S. has also imposed new vessel security laws on cruise ships that dock in U.S. ports. And this highlights something that you don't hear about, which is, one, people falling overboard on cruise ships. And so cruise ships are required to have rails that are at least 42 inches tall, and then also crime on cruise ships. And so passengers in crew cabins must have a means of visual identification, such as people. Ships must be equipped with technology to detect people falling overboard, as well as a video surveillance systems to document crimes. In certain high-risk areas, ships must have acoustic hailing and warning devices. Certainly, it hasn't been in the cruise ship's best interest to talk about crime on cruise ships. They will now be required to report that. So, interesting reading, all three of those articles. Check those out in the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. This show is again sponsored by Audible.com. The latest book that I've listened to on Audible is a nonfiction book, and that book is about social media, and it's called Groundswell, and it comes out of this Forrester group. And if you're interested in social media, it is a wonderful book talking about how it can be used in your business. To get your free subscription to Audible, 14-day subscription, as well as a free book, go to amateurtraveler.com/freebook. We were able to get somebody on the Egypt photo tour that's coming up here in November, even though it is past the deadline. So if you're still interested, it may not be too late. To find out more information, go to amateurtraveler.com/tours. I just got back from New Zealand this week, where I was there for 2 weeks. It was both Air New Zealand and the New Zealand Tourism Board that bought my ticket over, so thanks to both of those companies. And then also I had use of an RV made out of a Toyota minivan called a spaceship. And you can find more information about that by going to amateurtraveler.com/spaceship. And I'll talk about it in a little more detail later. And so thanks to them also for providing that for me to drive around New Zealand. I drove around the North Island. We have already done a show on New Zealand, and so if you're interested in more information about New Zealand, you might want to start with that show, which we'll talk about both North and South Island. Since I was going in what is New Zealand's winter, I just went to the North Island. And a special thanks to Craig and Linda Martin of the Indie Travel Podcast, who are my favorite Kiwis, who I sat down with in New York and helped me plan out an itinerary to see a lot of the interesting spots in the North Island in 2 weeks. And they were actually the guest on the other episode on New Zealand. I'll put a link to the other episode in the show notes. So I started out in Auckland because if you fly into New Zealand, Auckland is probably the easiest place to fly into. It is not the capital city, but it is the largest city in New Zealand, and it is the northernmost city, or the northernmost of the larger cities in New Zealand. Above there is North Country, and I did immediately from Auckland head north. I was heading towards the Bay of Islands, and the Bay of Islands is a wonderful destination, especially in the summertime, but even still in the wintertime, it was fun. And when I say I was in New Zealand in the wintertime, I should set some expectations because some of you live in places with actual winter. And so when I use that term, you're thinking snow. And I did actually see snow at one point on my trip, but that was when I drove up to the snow at a ski area on a volcano, and I'll get to that later. So New Zealand winter is very similar, in the North Island at least, to California winter, in the sense that I was in winter, and this is the coldest season of the year. It did freeze one night I was there. It was warm enough to wear short sleeves, I would say, most days I was there during the middle of the day, and everywhere I went was very green and very lush. So it does get a fair amount of rain, although I didn't see all that much of it while I was there. I had probably about 3 days of rain in the 12 days that I was there. Anyway, I headed north from Auckland to the Bay of Islands. And the Bay of Islands is the first place where the English started interacting with the Maori, and the Maori are the local Polynesian people from New Zealand. And the Maoris have been in New Zealand, or the land of the long white cloud, since sometime before the 1300s is the best guess. They didn't have a written history, so we're not quite as sure. But one of the reasons that I was heading up to the Bay of Islands is the Waitangi Treaty Grounds is there. And that is where the treaty that was signed that brought New Zealand under the authority of the King or Queen of England. Now, sort of, there was actually a problem in the translation of the treaty, and so the Maori copy of the treaty doesn't actually say that they lose their sovereignty, but the English copy did. It was, we believe, an honest mistake, and the person who led the guided tour that I was on and the treaty grounds was actually a great-great-great-granddaughter of both the person who was the first envoy from England, whose house the treaty signing ceremony took place on, as well as the person who did the unfortunate job of translation, who wasn't actually supposed to be doing the translation at all. His brother was supposed to be doing, but the treaty didn't arrive in time. And as well as the historic aspects, there's also a cultural presentation at the Waitangi Treaty Grounds, as well as a very long ceremonial Maori war canoe. While I was up in the Bay of Islands, I also went on a cruise up to the Hole in the Rock up in the Bay of Islands, which is about 100 different islands in the area. And that cruise is also a dolphin watching cruise. They see dolphins on 93% of the different cruises they go through. In the summertime, probably more people are willing to go into the water and swim with the dolphins. We had one person from a neighboring ship that was willing to venture out there to try and swim with a couple dolphins that we saw, but didn't actually get over to where the dolphins were. But that is something that was very enjoyable. And actually, both the dolphin cruise, and I'll put a link to that, as well as the Waitangi Treaty Grounds guided tour, I was on a pass from the tourism board that enabled me to do both of those for free. So that was very handy to have that pass. On the way up to the Bay of Islands, I stopped in Matakana, which has a wonderful farmer's market and vineyards in the area. And I'll put a link to one of the vineyards that I went to that had a lovely sculpture walk. And after that, I went down to the Coromandel Peninsula, which is back again east of Auckland, and enjoyed a couple of the different sites there. Did a hike up to Cathedral Cove, as well as went to Hot Water Beach. And Hot Water Beach is a beach that has a hot spring under it. And within a couple hours of high tide, you can dig a pit in the sand there and make your own homemade spa. So that was very enjoyable as well. From there, I climbed Mount Maunganui, and I stumble over all of these Maori words. The only real trick with Maori, it is a Polynesian language, so it has long words, but also the WH that appears in some words is actually an F sound, which is the difference between Maori, for instance, and Hawaiian. And then actually, one of the other highlights of the trip I can't tell you about, and this is a real strange thing for this show, but I went down to Mata Mata and did the Hobbiton tour there, which is a tour of the set that was used for Hobbiton for The Lord of the Rings. I did take pictures. I did go, and I can't tell you about it. I actually had to sign a release that I would not show the pictures and I would not describe anything that I saw there. So all I would say is it was one of the highlights of my tour, and you ought to go, and you ought to go soon. And from there, I went to Rotorua, and Rotorua is known for both its geothermal activities as well as presentations about the Maori culture. So I went to both. I went to an area called Te Puia, and Te Puia has both geothermal features, geysers, hot springs, mud pots, as well as a school of carving and a school of weaving, and then puts on an even better Maori cultural performance than I saw up at the treaty grounds. And this one, for instance, we had to elect a chief, and that chief had to do the ceremony of welcome with this particular Maori tribe. And so we saw the Maori warrior who presents a token to the chief, who has to decide to pick it up or to challenge the warrior. And the warrior goes through the ritual motions with a sort of club that is also a spear. Before the Europeans came, the Maori did not have metal, and so this wooden weapon was a traditional weapon. And we saw dances and heard songs, as well as the famous Maori haka, which is the very intimidating war dance that the Maori use to try and intimidate their enemies that the All Blacks still use at the beginning of their games. I also went to the Rotorua Museum, and the Rotorua Museum talks about trying to open up an area of baths on a similar lines of Bath in England to try and draw tourism. And then also, there used to be world-famous terraces, very similar to the terraces in Turkey at Pamukkale, called the White Terraces and the Pink Terraces, that were on a lake out of town that was somewhat difficult to get to, but it was starting to get a fair amount of tourism for the very adventurous in Victorian times. But then the local volcano erupted and wiped out those terraces as well as that whole valley. And the Rotorua Museum has a reenactment of that in their theater, which is something that is worth seeing. And then you can also tour that particular volcanic valley, which is the newest geothermal area and the only one created in historic times. And you can hike down for about 2 hours through this area of geothermal activity and then go out and tour on the lake, which was formed by that volcano eruption in the 1800s. And then I went down to the southern part of the island to Napier, which is known as the Art Deco City. I'd have to say Napier was the one place that I was a little disappointed in. I'm a real big fan of the Art Deco style, but I didn't really see as much in Napier as I expected. I guess I was expecting something a little more grandiose than what I saw in Napier, so that was a little disappointing. But then went down to the capital of Wellington. In Wellington, I toured the Te Papa Museum, which is a wonderful museum, a free museum, both a natural history museum, a science museum, as well as some wonderful, again, presentations about the Maori culture. And also went on a tour of the Parliament buildings there, since Wellington is the capital. It did rain while I was in Wellington. This is winter, of course, despite all the wonderful weather I had, and so I wasn't able to do some of the outside activities. As I headed back north again to finish this circuit, I took a detour the next day because I saw a sign for National Park and came across a national park in the middle of the North Island, and that was the Tongariro National Park, which is actually a UNESCO heritage site. We talked about UNESCO heritage sites numerous times on the show, and that looks like it has two distinct volcanoes, although both are actually part of the same volcanic system. One is a vent of the other, and that's the Ruapehu and the less pronounceable Ungaruuohe volcano. And the Ruapehu volcano actually has a ski area, and so that is the one time that I mentioned that I did go up to the snow and was able to, even though I didn't go skiing or snowboarding, I did take the lifts up to just play tourist there at the Whakapapa ski area there on Ruapehu. And then the last thing that I did before coming back to Auckland and some of the Auckland museums, that was, again, the other highlight of the trip, and this is one of the big reasons that I wanted to go to the North Island. I had meant to do this on my other trip to New Zealand, and that was go to the Waitomo Caves. And the Waitomo Caves are not that far from Auckland, and they are known for their glowworms, for one thing. And a glowworm is a type of insect that has a larval stage, and in their larval stage, they cling as a kind of thin smear of translucent jelly at the top of a cave, and they glow to attract insects that have been swept into the cave systems through the air vents, and they extend down from their bodies a series of web strands that dangle down from the top of the cave, maybe about 8 inches down, and as the insects are drawn to the light, they hit one of these webs of death, and they are stuck there, and the larva will draw that up and then eat them. And later on, they will turn into a chrysalis and then an insect, lay eggs, and then probably get caught in one of the webs themselves and die shortly thereafter. So a fascinating insect that you can find apparently all over New Zealand, but the Waitomo Cave area is particularly known for the glowworm cave. So I toured that, but then the real highlight was I went blackwater rafting. And if you're not familiar with blackwater rafting, I donned a full wetsuit, and when I say full wetsuit, I didn't wear a hood, but I basically had booties all the way up to my neck of wetsuit, and then had boots on over that, and then a helmet and a light on it, and we went down into the cave system. We spent about an hour down underground with the wetsuits because the water of the underground river that flows through there is about 50 degrees Fahrenheit, and then we brought an inner tube down there, and so you spend time crawling around the cave system as well as tubing through the underground river. And that was as cool as I thought it would be, and cool in both sense. It was very cold water, as I mentioned, but it was also an interesting experience. A little adventuresome, because you're at times told to stand at the top of this small waterfall, and you really need to jump out over the rocks. And, oh, by the way, yes, there are eels in the water here, and we saw some while we were there. But part of the time, you're just cruising along underground in the complete dark, because you turn off your lights underneath these glowworms, and a very enjoyable experience. That was actually something that was on my bucket list that I crossed off last week. And so that was at least the one of the two highlights that I can tell you about that I did in New Zealand. In Auckland, I did a couple nice, very nice museums. The Moto Museum that talks about technology and motor vehicles, and that was actually more interesting and expansive than I expected, showing a lot about the culture of New Zealand and how it has differentiated itself, for instance, from the mother country, and then also the Auckland Museum, which again has a lot of the cultural aspects, a lot of the Maori history, and then also an Imperial War Museum at the top story of that. And then the normal questions that I ask the guests, for instance, are what are the highlights? And again, I said the highlights would probably be the Blackwater rafting and then Hobbiton, which I can't tell you more details about. And in terms of where you should stay, again, I was using an RV on this, and it was very interesting because there's a strong camping culture in New Zealand. And so I had an RV as this spaceship again, and in more details, amateurtraveler.com/spaceship. That is this minivan that has been outfitted with a stove and with a cooler and with storage space and then can fit a full bed. And in the winter months, you can close the whole thing up and stay snug and warm, even although the one day that it did freeze at night got a little chilly in there. But in the summer months, you can also open it up and put up awnings on the outside that allow you to extend into the outdoors. So very interesting camping system. I really enjoyed driving that around. It gave me a lot of flexibility. Although it was interesting because the company that does this also do bus tours. And they said that what they found is a lot of people wanted to do these independent tours, but they ended up still going to the same places as the bus tours go. So bus tour is another option. If you're alone, it's probably more economical to do the bus tour. And certainly if you're young and single, that might be more fun too. But when you are using the RV or you're camping, you don't actually have to have an RV. All of the campgrounds I went to also had small cabins, and these would be maybe 8x8 with bunk beds inside and maybe a cooler and a microwave as well. I was navigating around using a GPS system that came with the spaceship. The name of my spaceship, by the way, was Oracle. They have 250 in New Zealand, and they're also in Australia and UK, and are coming, I believe, to Canada and the United States. But using the GPS system, I could always, when I was tired of driving for the day, just say, find me a campground, and I was never probably more than 10 to 14 kilometers away from the nearest campground, and I would drive in and pay roughly, for a single person, not with power, 10 to 25 New Zealand dollars per the night. And the exchange rate was 1.4 New Zealand dollars for every US dollar. So that's a pretty affordable rate in terms of that. Gas is much more expensive. Gas was about $1.75 per liter. So that is more expensive than we pay here in the United States. Probably more similar to what you'd pay in Europe. And when you stay in one of these campgrounds, there are more rustic campsites, in fact, that might even be free, that would be in the parks, but these would typically be for that price. You'd be getting something that had a hot shower, probably a kitchen facility, potentially also a TV room, and quite often Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi was one of the interesting things, and in terms of warnings, that was one of the things that caught me a little bit by surprise. Most of the Wi-Fi signals that I found, and I did bring my laptop because I had intended to blog and intended to upload pictures and such, and didn't end up doing as much of that as I expected because almost every single connection I found was bandwidth limited. So for instance, you'd buy an hour of internet, but it would also have a cap of 50 megabytes. And the pictures that I upload tend to be about 5 megabytes per picture. And I often, for the first week, I actually wasn't able to upload pictures at all. So that was something that was a little surprising. In the cities, like in Wellington, I was able to find internet cafes with good internet. But in the campgrounds, that was not the case. So that would be one warning that I would give. And driving outside did not take as long to get used to as I thought. At first couple days, every time I went to make a turn, I had to tell myself that left is easy and right is hard, and just remember to go in the right lane. But it really didn't take all that long, and not that often did I accidentally turn into the wrong lane. I think that happened twice, and always when there was no traffic going around. So really never get myself in trouble there. So the roads are a little narrower than they are in the U.S., but there isn't really a lot of traffic, and I'd say the drivers were fairly considerate, probably a little less patient in the major cities just as they are in the U.S. I did actually spend one night in a motel near Waitomo Caves, because that was actually a motel that I was able to get free because of this Explore New Zealand pass I had. And again, that got me into quite a few of the events that I went to and some of the museums that were not free museums without a charge. So that was a wonderful gift of the New Zealand Tourism Board. But staying in this motel, I happened to meet Fraser, who was the manager of the hotel. He and his wife had me over for a cup of tea, and we were able to talk for a while. He was a top dresser, is his other job. And for those of you who don't know what that is, that has nothing to do with what he wore, but that is what we would call in the United States a crop duster. So it was enjoyable to have a conversation with locals for a couple hours and get out of the aloneness, which I found that with the disadvantage, for instance, of traveling by myself in an RV is that you don't connect as much to the culture, you don't connect as much to people, and especially when you're going in winter and things get dark very early, there isn't as much to do except things on your own. I was able to entertain myself. But one of the other surprises was that it is apparently not as popular to go out to dinner in New Zealand as it is where I am from. And so about half the restaurants I would walk by in the small towns as well as the major cities would be closed for dinner time, even by about 5 o'clock. And so it was more common for people to go out for breakfast and lunch. And I don't know that anything really stands out as typical New Zealand for me in terms of the food. I ate a lot of Chinese takeout because that would be what would be open in the evening. Probably the meat pies, I would say, would be probably the more typical New Zealand fare. And then, of course, I did mention wineries. There are wineries in a couple different regions around New Zealand, although not as many open for tastings in the winter time. Quite a few of them had signs that they'd be open for tasting in the summer. And one of the questions I usually ask is, when did you feel furthest from home or closest to home? One thing that surprised me, although I had been to Auckland before, I really hadn't seen the rest of the North Island, and so much of it reminded me of parts of California. I'd say the coastline down by Wellington reminded me of Santa Barbara. The rolling hills by Matamata, which is where the Hobbiton set, for instance, was, reminds me of some of the inland hills in California, not too far, for instance, from where I live. The coastline reminded me of the northern coast of California. The only difference, of course, would be it would get warmer as you go north instead of warmer as you go south. But very familiar, except perhaps for fern trees, which is not something we have here. And some of the other trees are also different, but very familiar, very beautiful country. Really enjoyed going out, for instance, for the hike in Cathedral Cove. And also geothermal activity, since we also have some of that here, although not as much as they have in New Zealand. And we have a few volcanoes, but not quite as active as some of the ones in New Zealand still are. And the best day I had would definitely be the Blackwater rafting trip. That is definitely something I would recommend. If you didn't get a chance to do the Glowworm Caves, I wouldn't worry too much about that. But if you do have an adventurous spirit, you could do the Blackwater rafting. If you have a real adventurous spirit, you could do what I didn't do, which is abseiling. Now, one of the reasons that I was only in New Zealand for 2 weeks is, my understanding is, if you're there for more than 2 weeks, you have to jump off something. And New Zealand invented things like bungee jumping, and so there is always an opportunity to do something really life-threateningly stupid in New Zealand, it seems. I did get a chance to visit, for instance, the place where they do zorbing. And if you're not familiar with zorbing is when you get in a great big plastic ball, and you can either do a wet zorbing or dry zorbing. And I was too large for dry zorbing, I was told. In dry zorbing, they strap you to the inside chamber, to the outside wall of the inside chamber of this big plastic ball. And when I say big plastic ball, probably about 10 feet in diameter, and they roll you down a hill. In wet zorbing, it's the same thing, except you're in a partial wetsuit and you're inside this inner chamber with water so that you keep slipping so that you stay at the bottom of the ball, of the bottom of the inside chamber of the ball, again, as you go bouncing down the hill. So that is another thing that I did not try because I have this strange sense of self-preservation. That was near Rotorua, which also had the Agrodome, which I didn't do. They had a sheep shearing and sheepdog show there at the Agrodome, but I have uncles who had farms, so I really didn't feel that I needed to do that. I did see a sheep shearing demonstration in Matamata. There aren't as many sheep as there used to be in New Zealand. That is probably something you've heard about New Zealand, but there aren't as many because they don't get it that much for the wool anymore. The prices of wool have really gone down, but a good sheep shearer can do 600 to a record of over 800 sheep per hour. So that is something that is interesting to watch, unless, of course, perhaps you are a sheep. I think perhaps the other surprise for me is how much a part of the culture still the Maori culture is, and how widespread the influence was still of the Maori people within the island. Still make up a fair segment of the population. And so that was very enjoyable to learn more about them and to go to some of the meeting houses and see some of the amazing carving, for instance. And of course, make a fool of myself participating in doing the haka. And certainly the moment when I'd say you really know you're in New Zealand, I think of Tipuia, where you are watching a Maori dance while you're smelling the sulfur from the nearby geothermal activities. That's really the moment for me that you really know you're in New Zealand. And if I had to summarize New Zealand in three words, especially the North Island where I was, I would say verdant, not just green, but just really wonderfully lush green, geothermal, and Maori, and just use that because of the strong cultural influence that people have left on the island of the Long White Cloud. I should apologize for the voice that I've had while I record this show. I picked up a cold probably on the flight back when I was behind the crying two-year-old for much of the 12 hours of the flight. I didn't get quite as much sleep as I was hoping to. If you haven't read the Amateur Traveler blog recently, there are articles there about Boston and what to see, especially when you're there in the summertime, as well as pictures of the New Zealand trip that I have put up so far, and an article about the things that made me fall in love with New York, some of the small neighborhoods there. Got some great comments on those as well. And then, even though I hadn't put up this episode about New Zealand yet, I did get this comment about one of the pictures on New Zealand about Auckland. Cool picture. I liked the city very much when I was there, but for some reason, my family had a real hard time finding places to eat. Not that there weren't many around. We spent a long time there running around looking for specific places. So you may have been running into some of the problems I was running into, Aurora, with places closing at night, but it sounds like maybe you were just using an older tour book. You can have that in any place if you have an older tour book, that a lot of places will not be there anymore. So that's one of the disadvantages with using a tour book in general. And then I had posted a picture recently of Fort Tryon Park, which is at the northern end of Manhattan, which is where the Cloisters Museum is. And Evelyn had commented on that. Chris, I grew up in Inwood, and Fort Tryon Park was my front yard. The next time you visit my old nabe, check out Dickman House, the last Dutch farmhouse in Manhattan, dating from 1784. Also get a copy of my New York City guidebook, Peaceful Places in New York, 139 Tranquil Sites. I like the idea of peaceful places in New York, and I'm intrigued, I would have to say, Evelyn, by your guidebook, so I'll have to check that out. Tom did comment on the Prince Edward Island episode. PEI is a good place to visit, but the water is never warm enough for me to enjoy swimming. Tom, it sounds like you should probably also not come to Northern California where I live, because the water is also not warm enough to swim unless you like wearing a wetsuit. With that, I think we'll start to wrap this show up so you don't have to listen to this voice any longer and so I can get this out on time. If you have any comments, feel free to send them to host@amateurtraveler.com or leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. And as always, thanks so much for listening.